This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Regime change in Iraq is part of an ongoing American foreign policy, according to journalist Stephen Kinzer. He writes, the invasion of Iraq was the culmination of a 110-year period during which Americans overthrew 14 governments that displeased them for various ideological, political, and economic reasons. He says most of these operations, like Iraq, seemed to work at first and then had terrible unintended consequences. Kinzer has written a new book called Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. He writes about 14 places where the U.S. was the decisive factor in overthrowing the government. These are Hawaii, Cuba, the Philippines, Puerto Rico, Nicaragua, Honduras, Iran, Guatemala, South Vietnam, Chile, Grenada, Panama, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Kinzer recently left the New York Times, where he served as bureau chief in Turkey, Germany, and Nicaragua. He's also worked as the Boston Globe's Latin America bureau chief. He's written earlier books about America's role in the coups in Iran and Guatemala, two of the 14 regime changes also covered in his new book. Are there certain patterns that you think hold together the various eras of regime change that you write about?
Yes. With a few exceptions, most of them do fall into certain patterns. First of all, in almost every case, the reason why the United States first became focused on a country was economic. We didn't like the fact that our companies, whether it's an oil company or a banana company or a sugar company or a copper company, was not being allowed freedom to operate the way we thought it should in a foreign country. The people who run these companies, many of whom are often closely tied with the U.S. government, protest to American officials. And it is the economic motive that brings these countries to the attention of policymakers first. We never would have even thought about overthrowing the government of Iran if oil companies had not been howling in protest at Iran's nationalization of the oil industry. We would never have overthrown the government of Guatemala if the United Fruit Company had not been so upset about the policies of that Guatemalan government. However, although it is economic motives that bring these countries and their regimes to the attention of the White House and the State Department and other agencies, we actually frame our intervention in other ways. The U.S. government then transmutes the economic argument into a political argument. We begin to think that since these regimes are bothering American corporations, they must be hostile to U.S. interests in general. And in order for them to be hostile to U.S. interests, they must be an enemy. They must be probably manipulated by some foreign power that is anti-American. Another pattern is that in the long run, these interventions almost always turn out disastrously. When I look back at some of these operations and try to think how the world might have been different had we not launched them, it's enough sometimes to make you cry. Imagine if we could have had a stable, democratic Iran in the Middle East for the last 50 years. I can hardly wrap my mind around what the Middle East might look like now. Some of these operations have been moral catastrophes, like Guatemala, where hundreds of thousands of people were killed in 30 years of civil war that was set off by our coup there. But they also result in weakening the strategic position of the United States in the long run.
Now, you say that our policy of regime change actually started in 1893 with the overthrow of the Hawaiian monarchy. What were the U.S. interests in Hawaii at the time?
It's actually a very interesting story. The United States government was not directly involved in Hawaii at all. But starting in the 19th century, a group of American missionaries, mostly from New England, arrived in Hawaii to begin converting what they considered to be the heathen savages. And over a period of decades, many of these missionaries and their sons became aware that they could make a lot of money in Hawaii. There had always been sugar grown in Hawaii by natives, but it had never been refined or exported. Soon, the sons and grandsons of these missionaries built up very large sugar interests. But the United States passed a series of laws, including tariffs, that made it very difficult for the Hawaiian sugar planters to export their sugar into the United States. the only way that they could get rid of these tariffs and build up their industry and protect their profits was to bring Hawaii into the United States. So with the cooperation of the President of the United States, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of the Navy, an operation was launched in Hawaii by a group of white Hawaiians, that is to say, descendants of missionaries and sugar planters, who worked with the American consul and the commander of an American naval vessel that was conveniently posted off the shore of Honolulu. So together, this group of only a few dozen people overthrew the monarchy of Hawaii. And before the forces of the monarchy were able to respond, United States troops marched off that ship and occupied Honolulu, making it clear that any resistance was futile. So that led to the overthrow of that monarchy and, after a few years, the annexation of Hawaii into the United States. So it was sugar that was really at the root of why Hawaii became part of the United States.
So this was a peaceful overthrow?
It was done on a single day. It was an uprising. There was one person wounded during the course of the day. There were clashes. But since the United States had posted a military vessel off the coast of Honolulu and made clear that it favored the revolutionists' side, it was quite foolish, unthinkable, really, for the Hawaiian regime to try to respond. In fact, the Queen convened all the foreign ambassadors in Hawaii, there were about a dozen of them then, and asked them, what should I do? Shall we try to fight, or shall we just accept this and then try to resolve the problem by peaceful means later? And all the other ambassadors told her, you cannot try to fight against the U.S. Marines. I think they were wise when they told her that. So it was a peaceful takeover, but with the threat of force.
Now, you say that this overthrow was approved by the American president, but soon after a new president took office and denounced it. Who were the presidents, and how did their opinions differ?
That's an interesting story. President Benjamin Harrison was in office at the time that the Hawaiian coup was staged. One of the leaders of the coup, in fact, the principal leader, Lauren Thurston, actually came to Washington to meet with the president. So right after the coup in Hawaii, the new regime applied for entry into the United States, and President Harrison submitted a treaty to the U.S. Senate to achieve that. However, it took some weeks before the Senate got to it. There was a lot of angry publicity in the United States about this operation. Many people were very upset that it had happened. And then President Grover Cleveland took office. He was an anti-imperialist and not only disapproved of the coup, but made some efforts to try to replace the Queen on her throne. That did not succeed, but Hawaii, not being able to enter the United States, became an independent country. And so it was for 5 years until President McKinley came into office. Then, during the Spanish-American War in 1898, when the U.S. was seizing the Philippines, Hawaii was presented as a valuable stepping stone to the Philippines. And at that moment, the Senate caught up in a great frenzy of expansion, as it was in the summer of 1898, voted to annex Hawaii. So there was a 5-year interlude between the coup and the time Hawaii actually became American.
Now, you think that most of the times we've practiced regime change in another country, it's had really bad consequences. Do you feel that way about Hawaii?
Hawaii might be one of the exceptions. I think Hawaiians are now enjoying the privileges of membership in the United States. They're full U.S. citizens. We took full responsibility for Hawaii rather than assigning local dictators to tyrannize it. I think that's one of the big differences. You might say the same thing about Puerto Rico. There's resentment and I think resistance both in Hawaii and in Puerto Rico to the fact that the United States absorbed them in this way and has not always treated them fairly. Nonetheless, looking around the neighborhood, I think Hawaiians and Puerto Ricans might well be able to say that, considering the other alternatives, things haven't turned out so badly for them. And that was because the Americans actually decided that they would absorb these countries and, at least after a period of neglect, try to encourage the development of democratic institutions there. This is something very different from what we did in many other countries.
Now, you write that the overthrow of the monarchy in Hawaii in 1893 didn't have a grand vision of American power, but the Spanish-American War 5 years later did. What was that vision of American power in 1898?
That was the time when the U.S. was seized by a fervor for overseas expansion. Essentially, the U.S. had been expanding within the North American continent ever since the Pilgrims arrived. But by 1890, the frontier was officially declared to be closed, and there was no more room for the United States to expand within North America. But the expansionist impulse was still very strong. We looked at Cuba, we looked at Puerto Rico and the Philippines as places that should be under our influence because they were close enough to us, at least in the case of Cuba and Puerto Rico. They all were under Spanish colonial rule. The press built up a terrifying image of the brutality of Spanish colonialism. And then, of course, the key incident came when the United States battleship, the Maine, was exploded, blown up in Havana Harbor. That was seen as an act of war by Spain, and it became something like the version of weapons of mass destruction. That became the reason why we felt we had to go into Cuba and fight the Spanish there, because they had blown up our battleship and killed hundreds of our soldiers. It wasn't until more than half a century later that the Navy actually launched an investigation and found out that that blowing up of the Maine was actually an accident. Nonetheless, the U.S. was seized with this fervor for expansionism, and it fits in with the pattern that we will see throughout the 20th century, which is that economic interests began the operation. We had a lot of interests in Cuba, large agricultural interests, including big sugar plantations. We exported a lot of goods there, and it was the desire of those companies and those businessmen to act more freely in Cuba, to have a regime in Cuba that would be friendly to their interests, that first brought these questions to the attention of the American government. But it was the idea of expanding American strategic power and liberating the oppressed victims of colonialism that was actually used as the explanation, the excuse, the justification for launching that war.
Now, you write that when we intervened in Cuba, we promised that American troops would withdraw as soon as the fighting was over. Did we?
This was a very interesting story. When the United States decided it would send troops into Cuba to help the Cuban patriots rebel against Spanish colonialism, the Cubans were quite wary. They weren't so sure they wanted a lot of American troops on their soil because they didn't know what would happen after the victory. As a result of this concern, the U.S. Senate passed a law that said that the U.S. promised that it would withdraw all its American troops from Cuba as soon as the revolution against Spain was won. Once that resolution was passed, that law was passed, the Cuban patriots agreed. Then they said, okay, you've already promised in law that you will withdraw, so yes, we will welcome your help. The Americans arrived, and then immediately after the Spanish were defeated and the Cuban patriots were victorious, the Americans changed their mind. They decided, well, that law was passed in a moment of over-enthusiasm, and now that we look at Cuba and we consider the possibility that it could have a completely independent government, one that is going to consider the interests of Cuba first, not the interests of the United States first, we decided, no, this is not what we want. So instead, we never did withdraw our troops. We maintained a military governorship of Cuba for some decades and then turned Cuba over to a series of dictators who did our bidding. One of the results of this was that in 1952, one of those dictators canceled the election in which a young student leader, Fidel Castro, was running for Congress. That's what led Castro to decide that he would launch a revolution instead. And amazingly enough, after Castro won the revolution in January of 1959, he came down from the hills into Santiago And in his very first speech as the victorious leader of the revolution, he made no promises. He did not describe what kind of a regime he was going to impose, but he only made one statement. He said, "I promise you this. This is not going to be like 1898 again, when the Americans came in and made themselves masters of our country." Now, I bet anyone in the United States who heard that speech would wonder, what is he talking about? He's talking about something that happened more than half a century ago. It's because we in America tend to forget these episodes, these overthrows, these interventions very quickly, but they burn in the souls and the hearts and the consciousnesses of the people in the countries in which we've intervened. And although the ill effects do not appear immediately, they ultimately do.
Under President Eisenhower, the United States overthrew regimes in Iran and Guatemala. President Eisenhower's Secretary of State was John Foster Dulles, who, you point out, had spent decades working for some of the world's most powerful corporations before becoming Secretary of State. Who had he worked for?
He was a partner, in fact, the managing partner, in a legendary law firm in New York, Sullivan and Cromwell. When you read over his list of clients, it's nothing less than a list of the most powerful corporations in the world. He represented United Fruit. He represented International Nickel, which was one of the great resource consortiums in the world. His clients dug ports in Peru, and they had mines in Colombia. He negotiated contracts for loans to Arabian countries. He sued the Soviet Union for insurance companies. He was the preeminent corporate lawyer in America. So after spending nearly all of his adult life in the service of the largest and most powerful American corporations, he became the U.S. Secretary of State and brought with him a perspective that was very business-oriented. He had come from a background of great privilege and believed that protecting American corporations in the world was something almost holy. And in fact, the holiness was also a part of his character. He came from a family of religious leaders. His father was a minister. His grandfather was a clergyman and a missionary in India. He himself had at one point thought of becoming a clergyman. So he was a person who also prefigured another aspect of American expansionism, which is the religious aspect, the aspect that the United States has been chosen by God to spread certain holy principles, and that since the United States has been so fortunate, so lucky in producing a country that is based on prosperity and democracy, it is not only our right, but actually our responsibility to share our good fortune with other countries and allow them or force them to embrace governments that are favorable to American interests, because those are the interests that God wants the world to follow.
Had Dulles worked for the oil industry? Had he represented the oil industry as a lawyer?
Yes, he had several clients throughout Latin America that were drilling for oil. He represented oil interests in the Middle East and essentially was the go-to lawyer in America for any large corporation that had interests abroad.
Do you think he represents something new in terms of the having somebody in such a high-placed position who had such a corporate multinational kind of background?
There had been a number of other people before him who came from this background. Philander Knox, who was the Secretary of State that wrote the letter to President Zelaya in Nicaragua, essentially firing him, was also a very important corporate lawyer who represented corporations in Nicaragua that were not being allowed to function freely because President Zelaya wanted them to observe labor laws and pay taxes and so forth. So when Knox came into office, he made it one of his priorities to overthrow Zelaya. However, I don't think there has ever been, either before or since, a leading figure in the American government who is so closely tied to corporate interests. In fact, Dulles represents a change because he doesn't only speak on behalf of corporate interests, but he is corporate interests. That is, he himself spent his entire life at the service of foreign corporations. This has not always been the case for American leaders. Many of the American figures who promoted intervention abroad, like Henry Kissinger, for example, have no business background and actually look at business with a kind of disdain. But Dulles was quite different. He really believed that no country would ever bother American corporations unless it was evilly motivated and probably a representative of a force determined to destroy the United States. He never was able to grasp the idea that people in foreign countries want to control their own resources.
Now, you suggest in your book that you think one of the reasons why we've intervened in other countries is because we misinterpreted their expressions of nationalism.
American diplomats and American statesmen and American leaders are by nature Eurocentric. Everything that American diplomats learn about the world is more or less based on the experience of Europe. We study European diplomacy and European history. We understand European historical patterns such as wars of conquest and shifting alliances and power blocks. But we do not understand the intensity of nationalism in developing countries. In the period after World War II, the winds of nationalism were sweeping across Asia and Africa and Latin America. What that brought to the peoples of those countries was a fervent desire to take control of their own natural resources. They began to see that they had great natural wealth, but they were very poor. Why was this? Because the natural wealth of their countries was being used for the profit of foreign corporations. They expressed their nationalism by trying to take back control of these resources. That naturally alienated the American and other foreign companies that were working in those countries. Now, the desire of people in poor countries to take control of their natural resources is not part of the European tradition. It's not something that ever was part of European history. Therefore, Americans were not able to understand it. And I think we began to believe that all of these attempts to reclaim control over natural resources were part of an international anti-American conspiracy, probably directed by the Kremlin, and that any regime in any foreign country that would try to molest or bother or restrict American companies must be probably socialistic and most likely a pawn of the Kremlin. Therefore, we would move to overthrow it. So we overreacted in a terrible way to regimes that actually were only expressing American principles and in their place imposed leaders who despised everything that the United States stands for.
Now, you've talked about how America's interventions in Latin America have left a strong anti-U.S. sentiment there. President Chavez of Venezuela and President Morales of Bolivia have been speaking very nationalistically. Do you think that there's going to be a conflict between the U.S. and those countries?
Our actions in Latin America have probably been more shamefully interventionist and have produced more horrific results than our interventions anywhere else in the world. There's really a very fertile ground for anti-Americanism there. The speeches that you hear from leaders like Chavez are full of references to the times the United States has intervened in Guatemala, in Nicaragua, in Dominican Republic, in Cuba, in Chile, and so forth. So our interventions there are now being used as proof that we have only evil intentions in Latin America. Whether that's true or not, there's certainly plenty of historical evidence to support that argument.
So do you see more conflict ahead between those presidents and the United States?
These days, the United States seems completely to have given up on or stopped paying attention to Latin America. Latin America has moved way down to the bottom of our list of concerns. That provides an opening for anti-American leaders like Chavez and others who support him to leap into this gap and to say that since the U.S. has been so evil to us in the past and is ignoring us now, we need to find a new paradigm. And since no one else is offering one, since the United States is not offering a kind of creative alternative in Latin America, the Chavez message is really the only one that's circulating around that region.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stephen Kinzer. He was a longtime correspondent for the New York Times, a foreign correspondent who covered about 50 countries. His new book is called Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. Having looked at the 14 regime changes that you cover in your new book, Overthrow, starting with Hawaii, ending with Iraq, what do you emerge as the larger lessons? of regime change?
If there's one overriding lesson, it is that violently interrupting the political processes in foreign countries always has terrible effects in the end. We got to start to look at these interventions in a longer time frame and not just imagine what's going to happen in the months or the next few years after we do it. Take Iran as an example. We overthrew the government of Iran, which was a functioning democracy, in 1953. Now, for 25 years, we benefited from that overthrow. We had the Shah's regime in power. The Shah did more or less whatever we wanted. He gave us access to his oil. He allowed us to use Iran as our strategic platform in the Middle East. So that operation seemed like a success for quite a long time. But the regime that we placed in power in Iran, the Shah's regime, produced the explosion of the late 1970s that we call the Islamic Revolution. It brought a fanatically anti-American clerical regime to power, which began its period in office by seizing American diplomats as hostages and has spent the last 25 years working fervently to undermine American interests all over the world. And now we are at the brink of another big world crisis with Iran. All of this can be traced back to episodes that happened more than half a century ago. Cuba is another example. Had we not intervened in Cuba in the late 19th century, we might never have been faced with the whole Castro communist Cuba phenomenon. So when we intervene, we're doing something like what you do when you release a wheel at the top of a hill. You can never tell where that wheel is going to bounce and where it's going to end up. These interventions abroad, these overthrows of foreign governments, not only plunge whole regions of the world into instability and turn them into places from which undreamed of threats emerge years later, but they undermine American security. They're not just bad for the countries where we intervene. You cannot violently overthrow a foreign regime and then expect that that won't have any long-term effect. It's like beating your child every day. You cannot expect that that child is going to grow up normal.
You know, you look at the consequences of the United States overthrowing of other governments. If we just take the Cold War era, for example, the argument could be made that had we not intervened in other countries the way we had, that the Soviets might have expanded more and more successfully. And in fact, the Soviets might have won the Cold War.
I don't think that's true at all. In the first place, the countries whose governments we overthrew, all countries that we claimed were pawns of the Kremlin, actually were nothing of the sort. We now know, for example, that the Kremlin had not the slightest interest in Guatemala at all in the early 1950s. They didn't even know Guatemala existed. They didn't even have diplomatic or economic relations. The leader of Iran, who we overthrew, was fiercely anti-communist. He was came from an aristocratic family. He despised Marxist ideology. In Chile, we always portrayed President Allende as a cat's paw of the Kremlin. We now know from documents that have come out that the Soviets and the Chinese were constantly fighting with him and urging him to calm down and not be so provocative toward the Americans. So in the first place, the Soviets were not behind those regimes. We completely overestimated the influence of the Soviet Union on those regimes. But there's a second point. By intervening in those countries, we turned ourselves into an object of hatred and opprobrium, and we opened up millions of hearts around the world to communism and to the ideology of America's enemies. We have promoted anti-American sentiment around the world by these interventions and thereby strengthened our enemies.
I'm interested in what you think now of the spread of radical Islam. You know, you covered Turkey for a long time. You have a book about the history of Turkey. Turkey is a large Islamic country and the most secular of the Islamic countries. So I guess it's a really big question about the spread of radical Islam. But I guess specifically what I'm wondering is, you know, like, post the Khartoum riots, is the power of radical Islam spreading to countries in which radical Islam itself isn't even strong? In other words, is the power of radical Islamists to say, if you publish this, you will be punished by us, spreading beyond their own countries?
We sometimes like to think that our interventions in these countries don't have effects. But when we break down the doors of foreign countries and impose our own leaders, as we did in Iran and as we've recently done in Iraq, we outrage a lot of people. We like to think that everybody will soon calmly come to realize that by rational standards, this was a good thing to do. But that doesn't happen. We are not able to change cultures as easily as we are able to change regimes. It's true that the cartoons were Danish, but in the Middle East, I think they're largely perceived as part of a Western conspiracy against Muslim interests in Muslim countries. After all, if you go to Iran, you'll still today find that Britain is still thought of as the real evil force in that part of the world as much as the United States. Therefore, they all blend together. But who has been the country that has been intervening there most boldly over the last half century? It's been the United States. So I think that opens up the possibility that anything that any Western country does is seen as a reflection of American attitudes. Interestingly enough, this is just the reverse of what we used to do. In the 1950s, we looked around the world and we saw every relatively innocent effort by countries to control their own natural resources as part of a Kremlin conspiracy. Now, what radical Muslim leaders in the Middle East are doing is exactly what we did. They are saying that everything that happens in the world that seems inimical or insulting to Muslim interests must be part of the U.S. conspiracy. And although that is not true, our actions in that part of the world have made that easy to believe.
You know, your book on the American history of regime change ends with Iraq. We've talked a little bit about larger historic themes that you think have been played out in Iraq. Is Iraq the first time that we've overthrown a government? And, you know, in a lot of other places, we helped install a leader that was favorable to the United States. You know, maybe an oppressive leader to their people, but still somebody who was seen as favorable in policy toward the United States, in some instances, somebody who we could control. In Iraq, right now, there almost is no government because they've been unable to agree on a government after the election. And we are in a position of having a lot of responsibility for Iraq, yet Iraq is, you know, appears to be nearing civil war. Is the predicament that we are now in Iraq unprecedented, as far as you can tell?
Absolutely not. You're now putting your finger on one of the crucial elements that ties all these interventions together. In almost every case when we've overthrown a government, soon afterward we have to put our own leader in power. After we overthrow the guy we don't like, we have to find someone we do like. And what we want from that leader is two things. We want to find somebody who's genuinely popular, who is admired, who has a popular base. And secondly, we want somebody that will support American interests. After all, we didn't overthrow a regime just so that we could have someone in power that doesn't like us. Soon after we face this dilemma, we find that these two factors are contradictory. You cannot have a leader who is both popular and pro-American. If he's popular, it means that he puts the interests of his own country first. But we don't want that. We want someone who will put the interests of the United States first. That's why we intervened in the first place. So this is the crucial moment in every intervention. We have to decide, who are we going to put in office now? Naturally, we have to choose between somebody who's popular and someone who will do what we want. And it's an easy choice, naturally. We choose someone who will do what we want. That person becomes less and less popular. We then have to support him as he uses more repression to keep himself in power. And that leads to a spiral like we've seen in so many countries where you have frustration, anger, rebellion. It shows you that you cannot combine these two things. You can't have leaders in foreign countries who are genuinely popular and who also put the interests of the United States ahead of their own national interests.
But our government has said the reason why we're in Iraq is to support democracy. And, you know, we've overseen an election there.
But we are very eager to assure that the next leader of Iraq and the leader after that and all future leaders will be favorable to American interests. It's not because we want them to be anti-Iraqi. But we have deluded ourselves into believing that whatever is good for the U.S. in Iraq will also be good for Iraqis in Iraq. We can't believe that there are many programs and projects and initiatives in Iraq that would benefit Iraq but would not be good for the United States, like Iraqi national control over its own oil resources and using oil as a weapon for achieving greater economic and strategic power. That's something every Iraqi would support, but it's not something Americans went in there to invade so that we could have someone there who wants to use Iraqi oil for its own strategic power. Therefore, we always are faced with this conflict. Do we want somebody who will do our bidding, or do we want someone who will think first of his own country? And naturally, we choose the latter, which leads us into the same spiral that we have gotten ourselves into in so many countries.
You were a long-term foreign correspondent for the New York Times. You recently left the paper. What's the difference for you being a kind of daily journalist at a newspaper and now just writing books?
I owe a lot to the New York Times because the Times sent me to a lot of places and put me in a lot of fascinating situations, and I learned a tremendous amount from those foreign assignments. On the other hand, at a certain point, I think I began to feel that I didn't want to be the slave of events anymore. I didn't want to have to rush off when there was a daily news story. I actually realized that although I was a newsman for more than 20 years, I am not interested in news. News is the opposite of information. I'm more interested in why something's happened and in what is going to happen in the future rather than in reporting just what happened today. What I liked to use as a guide for my own reporting was this. If something happens in a country that I'm covering, some big event happens, and you've been following my reporting all along, you won't be surprised because I prepared you for this. That's what I'm more interested in doing.
Stephen Kinzer, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's always a pleasure, Terry.
Stephen Kinzer's new book is called Overthrow. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org.